Never mind. You could get a gallon of not very good wine for around 3 shillings, so a few pennies should be more than enough to buy me a knife to eat with, a comb for my hair, some linen to cover my head, a second-hand dress from somewhere, and if I was really lucky, a good thick cloak for the winter. Things were looking up. I would walk to Rushford Market to try my luck. A thought struck me. I would need permission to leave the village. Well, I wasn't going to ask Walter. I would approach William. All this sounds very exciting and funny, and some parts of it were, and I've told you about them. What I hadn't mentioned are the long, dark nights when I lay alone on my stone floor, weeping quietly into my stole, trying to push away soul-crushing thoughts of fear and loss and loneliness, and failing utterly. Seeing Leon's blue eyes every time I close my own, feeling his arms around me, listening to his breathing as he slept beside me at night, feel the touch of his hands, and Matthew, with his shock of dark hair we couldn't persuade him to have cut, the way he slid his hand into mine when he wanted comfort but wouldn't admit it. I heard his oddly deep voice. Mummy shouted at Ma's scrope and she died. Mummy's awesome. And Peterson, with his gentle kindness and pain-filled eyes, and Markham, with his newfound sense of responsibility, and Dr. Bairstow, with his beaky nose, peering at me over his desk as he found something to complain about in one of my reports. Even Rosie Lee in our daily, sometimes hourly, skirmishes over who would make the tea. I missed them all. They were gone forever, as I was gone from them. And with that thought, I would curl up even more tightly and feel the tears run down my cheeks as I waited for another day to dawn without them. Chapter 25. We embarked on busy rebuilding. Tarpaulins were secured over the hall, which reminded me of my own time. William the carpenter was permitted to bring in extra labour. The sound of hammering and sawing echoed from dawn till dusk. The smell of new wood was everywhere. No one was hanging around. Winter would be here soon enough, and there was what remained of the harvest to get in. Livestock to fatten up, houses to make weatherproof. Firewood to be collected. Every cottage began to sprout enormous piles of wood that would last hardly any time at all. Being the most unskilled of all the unskilled labour, I was on firewood collecting duty. The rules were simple. If it was on the ground, then it was mine. I was forbidden on pain of death, and worse, to touch living wood. I spent days lugging back old bits of wood salvaged from the forest floor. The pile by the kitchen door never seemed to get any larger. Autumn began to happen. One night I awoke and I was freezing. The first frost is no fun if you sleep on a stone floor. When William had finished with his pot the next morning, I ventured into his room to make a request. "God give you good morning, sir." He grunted, pulling on his boots. His chattiness plumbed new depths in the early mornings. "Pack your gear." What? Why? Now what had I done? I said cautiously, "Pack my gear, all of it," as if I had trunks full of clothes and combs and mirrors. He finished with his boots and got to his feet. "Today we move to the solar." That was news to me. I mean, I knew he was moving out. As almost lord of the manor, he was entitled to better accommodation than this, and a toilet without a weird foreign woman sleeping in it too. I hadn't realised it was today, and I certainly hadn't realised I was going with him. I'd rather hoped for a little corner all to myself. Still, at least I wasn't one of the fittings to be passed on to Tam the Welshman when he succeeded to William's position. I said cautiously, "I have no gear, sir." He was on his way to the door. Now was a good moment to ask. "Sir, I crave leave to travel to Rushford." He stopped with his hand on the latch and looked at me. "You are leaving us? You are unhappy here?" "No, sir, not at all. I am much beholden to all here for their kindness and care."
"Then why? Do you have news of relatives there?"
"No, sir." I gestured at my by now very well-worn Persian tunic. "Sir, winter draws near, and I would go to Rushford for a warm cloak." No need to burden him with the rest of my shopping list. He seemed to see what I was wearing for the first time. He nodded.
I go there today. Be ready at the third hour. Terse.
I nodded and retreated back into my toilet. I made sure I was early. I didn't want to keep him waiting. He was my ride. They led out his horse, the big chestnut beast, Theobald. He snorted in the crisp morning air and tossed his head. William Hendred reached down for me. It seemed I was to ride Pillion. He didn't speak at all, but it was a pleasant ride. Theobald was a good horse, strong and easily able to carry both of us. We crossed the ford and trotted up through the village. Once away from the buildings, we broke into a canter, eating up the miles. Most of the path was through dense woodland, although at one point I saw what I took to be the village of Whittington, away among the trees. The sun was warm on my back. It was hard to believe that winter would be here soon. The trees were just beginning to turn gold. I heard Rushford before I saw it. The peal of the church bells carried across the river, that and the smoky haze over the old town told me we were getting close. It's always a surprise to see how low the buildings were at the time. There was nothing above two stories apart from the church towers and the castle itself, glowering down at everyone from its position on top of the hill. The rush was wide here and shallow, fast flowing over a gravel bed. We slowed and splashed through the ford. The town walls weren't high, not much higher than ours at St. Mary's, and the gates stood wide open. There was only one guard, and he was leaning against the wall, his pike leaning with him. It was market day, and everyone was welcome, their money even more so. Once in through the gate, where the guard greeted William respectfully by name, he disappeared into the first inn we came to. The old wooden sign denoted it as the Cedar Tree. I stood out in the street for a while, feeling like an idiot, unsure whether he expected me to wait or not, decided I wasn't getting any younger, and pushed off to see what I could see. Rushford was so much smaller than I remembered. There were very few buildings on the other side of the river. The majority of the buildings crouched around the base of the castle. Today was definitely market day. Stalls filled the narrow streets leading up to the castle. I took a tight grip on my purse and made my way slowly past metalworkers, haberdashers, furriers, shoemakers, gold merchants, spice sellers, butchers and bakers, all yelling their goods at the tops of their voices. I fought my way through a gaggle of geese, spitting and honking at everything in their path as they were driven down the street. Beggars sat or lay in the road, palms outstretched. Many of them were children. Finally, I came across a tiny stall rammed into a corner between two buildings. I liked the look of this one because it was run by a young woman. I examined her merchandise, looking for what I needed. I found a tiny comb I suspected was part of a much larger original. It was made of bone or ivory, I wasn't sure which, but it was just what I needed. I did my best to haggle, to look like someone who could easily walk away if the price wasn't right, but I was rubbish. I had to have a comb, and this was the only stall I'd seen that sold the sort of tat I could afford. I held out a coin. She shook her head and went to take another. I shook my head. She shrugged and stepped back. Bugger, this wasn't going well. And I really had to comb my hair. It was driving me insane. In the end, reluctantly, I nodded, and smilingly, she handed me the comb. I had a nasty feeling I'd paid well over the odds, and I think perhaps she felt a little guilty about it, because she included a small piece of hard grey soap in the deal. It wouldn't lather, but maybe I could use it to scrape my skin clean. I picked over some lengths of ribbon. I could really do with a touch of colour in my life. The red and green silk stole was fading fast under the bashing it was taking these days, but I couldn't afford to waste what might be the only money I might ever have in my entire life. I sighed and went to move on. She really was the most persuasive saleswoman I'd ever met. Unerringly, she picked out my favourite colours, holding up a handful of blue and green ribbons. And yes, she was right, and they would have looked wonderful, even on me, but no, I couldn't afford them. Shaking my head and smiling regretfully, I backed away. Now I needed to find a clothes stall, which, in an age when people made all their own clothes, could be difficult. Clothes were worn almost until they fell apart, and then had a new lease of life when they were cut down for the kids.
I was ranging up and down the stalls, looking for someone who looked as if they sold second-hand clothes, when a heavy hand fell on my shoulder. I jumped a mile, spun around, and found myself face to face with William Hendred. He stepped back, slightly astonished at my reaction. You could tell he'd never been kidnapped in his entire life, not even once. I pulled myself together and greeted him politely.
God's greeting, sir.
He nodded curtly. Come. Wondering why I always attracted the chatty ones, I followed him closely as he worked his way through the crowds. He stopped at a stall under the shadow of a large house. The front of the house was let down to display bolts of colourful cloth. I hung back. All of this was far too expensive for me. He pushed his way past the displays and we entered the house proper. A man bustled forwards, well-fed and well-dressed, obviously the shop owner. They greeted each other. I stood quietly looking around me. This small room also seemed part of his shop. More bolts of material were stacked around the walls, but in the corner, hanging from pegs, were items of clothing, male and female, but mostly female. The man stepped away and spoke to an underling who immediately cleared a space on one of the tables and began to unhook items of clothing and bring them over. I've never actually bought clothes when surrounded by men before, and I was quite embarrassed about it. I think William Hendred must have realised this, because he muttered something and took himself off out of the door. I made myself concentrate. Here were second-hand clothes of all types. I had no idea if they'd been traded in for new material or what, but I was grateful. I would never have found this on my own and certainly wouldn't have known what to ask for. The owner, whose name was Robert Sutton, or Sudden, I wasn't sure, and no one actually introduced him, and his man eyed me up and down, measuring my size, I hoped, and began to lay out various bits and pieces. Carefully sorting through the pile, I pulled out something in dark brown, a good practical colour. The length was too long, but Marjorie would help me cut some off. It had obviously been discarded because of a large stain all down the left-hand side. I sniffed it carefully. I think it was an oil stain. Still, I couldn't be choosy. If it didn't have the stain, I probably wouldn't be able to afford it. I laid it carefully to one side, and then saw something blue. This was the one. It had once been a very good dress. It still was, if you discounted the fact it had faded almost to grey over the years and had been ripped down one side. Again, Marjorie could help me mend that. I suspected it had been someone's pride and joy once. Dark patches showed around the neck, where an original piece of fur or embroidery had been removed and transferred to another garment. But the wool was good, soft and warm. This would do me well. The servant, murmuring respectfully, pulled out something in brown and held it up. A sleeveless surcoat, hopelessly old-fashioned, but again, good quality, and just what I needed as an extra layer for the winter, and not too long either. It was perfect. I nodded my thanks. William Hendred returned, spoke again to the owner, Master Sugden or Sutton, who barked a sharp command and someone found a cloak. A wonderful cloak. Thick and full, it was made of felted wool on the outside to make it waterproof, with a soft lining on the inside. There was enough of it to go around me twice. It even had a hood. It was wonderful. It was a cloak in which I could confidently face the winter. I could even sleep in it. Again, it wasn't perfect. The hem was ripped and ragged, and the hood needed a repair, but if it had been perfect, then it would have been too expensive for me. I was thrilled. Wrapping it around me again and again, feeling the weight and the warmth. I piled up the three garments and took out my tiny purse. I'm not sure what happened next. There was a great deal of talking, I know that. They went at it hard and fast. Initially, I thought they were having an argument and stepped back, worried that all this wonderful clothing would suddenly disappear and I'd have to get through the winter in a thin linen tunic and a battered and rapidly shrinking piece of silk stole. I reckoned I'd last until the end of September at the very latest. The servant, carefully folding the dress and surcoat and wrapping them in the cloak, winked at me and carried on with his task, completely unperturbed. Eventually, Master Sutton, or Sugden, made a gesture indicating he was ruined forever and to leave his premises forthwith before he was reduced to begging in the streets. William Hendred grinned and clapped him on the shoulder. Unsure of the outcome, I timidly produced my purse and shook the contents into my hand. Master Sutton was far too grand to handle money. His servant sorted through the coins and showed me what he'd taken. I nodded my approval. I still wasn't sure how much I'd paid for the whole lot, but this was not the time to argue, and was handed the surprisingly neat bundle. They said their goodbyes, good humour restored now that business was concluded. It seemed likely Master Sugden's, or Sutton's, business would survive at least until the next market day after all, and I found myself back out in the noisy street again. I would have thanked Master Hendred, but he shook his head, and I couldn't tell if he was embarrassed or irritated, so I let it go. I was so excited by my purchases, I wasn't a beggar any longer. I wasn't relying on the goodwill of other people. Well, I was, but I could pay my way now. I had a change of clothes. I could finally wash the ones I was wearing, and not a second before time, let me tell you. I could comb my hair properly. I had possessions to lay out on my stone shelf in the toilet, or wherever I ended up. A pieman stood on the corner with three or four people queuing before him. An historian tip. Always buy your pies from the vendor with the queue. If the locals are eating his wares, then they're probably okay. I nipped over and, juggling purse and bundle, bought two golden pies. I handed William Hendred one. He seemed so surprised that I wondered if I'd done something wrong. I probably had. I wondered if an unmarried woman buying an unmarried man a pie in public constituted forward behaviour, but I was grateful for his help, and this seemed an appropriate way to thank him. We walked away, eating and being jostled by the crowd. He said, "Give me your purse." I chewed, swallowed, and said thickly, "Why?" He sighed, "Cut purses." "Oh." I handed it over, and he tucked it in the front of his doublet for safety. Not that I thought anyone would rob him, anyway. He was obviously well known in the town. Men saluted him courteously or stepped back to give him room. I wanted to look around, to compare the Rushford I remembered with this older version, but the steep streets were too narrow and crowded, and I had to spend my time looking where I was going. The cobbles were slippery, badly laid in some places, and not at all in others. And there were people everywhere, shouting, arguing, selling things, buying things, greeting each other. Children ran in and out of groups of chattering people. Occasionally a man would try to push his horse through the throng. Men stood outside the taverns, talking, doing business, socialising. There were all sorts here, from street beggars clothed in rags and sitting against a wall, their hands held out for alms, to rich merchants striding through the streets as if they owned them, which they probably did. Women with baskets bought spices, inspected poultry, sniffed disparagingly at whatever was being held up for their pleasure, gossiped, and displayed their best dresses for admiration. We rounded a corner, and there was the castle. But not as I remembered it. In my day, the outer ward was gone, but here the walls were intact. I could see the drawbridge was down. A stream of people made their way in and out. Somewhere in there, Walter of Shrewsbury would be bustling about, full of importance, doing his master's business and thoroughly enjoying himself. I glanced up at William Hendred, who grinned at me. I suspected he'd had exactly the same thought. And then it was time to go home. I had another stroke of luck. We had returned to the cider tree where he had stabled his horse, and waiting outside was William the carpenter, complete with his family and cart. I was offered a place in the back along with all the little carpenters. I hopped in. William Hendred walked his horse with us back through the gate and then, once on the road home, broke into a canter and disappeared in a cloud of dust. I passed the journey home showing off my purchases and admiring theirs. For me, it was a happy day. There was one more thing to come. They took me to the ford. I jumped down from the carpenter's wagon, clutching my bundle of new clothing, eager to shake it all out and hang it up. I wanted to lay my comb on the stone shelf, along with the little piece of soap the stallholder had given me, but I wasn't given the chance. When I arrived at the gatehouse, Owen directed me across to the solar. I had forgotten. William was moving into the main building today. The door to the solar was to the left of the hall. I crossed the courtyard and stepped down into the sunny room where I'd first met Master Walter. It still smelled of burned wood. William Hendred was there. He nodded his head toward the stairs. I found my way up, wondering whose toilet I would be sleeping in this time.
There was a good bedroom up there. I could see William's stuff scattered around as young Roger carefully carried his belongings up the stairs. This was a comfortable room, not as grand as the rooms in the newer North Tower, which is where the family would lodge when they visited, but much more pleasant than the gatehouse. There were larger windows through which the sun streamed, hence the word solar. The floors were of wood, the walls plastered and painted with a swirly feather design in dark red. Roger pointed to a partitioned corner. Ah, I was in the toilet again. I felt a stab of resentment. They still didn't trust me. After everything I'd done, they still didn't trust me. I stepped behind the partition. It was a proper room, and it was lovely. There was a window with a view out over the carp ponds. There was even a niche in the wall in which someone, Roger, probably, had put a little rush light. Someone had placed a palliasse on the floor with a new blanket folded neatly on the top. And curled neatly on the blanket were two blue ribbons and two green ribbons. Chapter 26. Christmas was much jollier than I thought it would be. The hall and staircase were decorated with holly and ivy, woven into swags. The red berries looked cheerful amongst the greenery. The Yule log was brought in amid much laughter and ceremony, and even more drinking. William Hendred, Tam the Welshman, and a couple of others took the dogs and went hunting for hare, deer, or boar. We had a falconer, known as Nob, although I was sure that wasn't his real name, who took his birds out for rabbits. Someone slaughtered a pig, kept especially for the occasion, and any number of geese didn't make it through December. Fat Piers and his kitchen crew went into overdrive. His language became so fiery that either the dishes he was creating were truly magnificent, or he was auditioning for the medieval equivalent of a TV chef programme. Whatever the reason, we all benefited from the results. They'd also caught massive quantities of carp, which were now spending their days in barrels of fresh water, rather than the liquid mud of the carp ponds outside, the reason being, it was explained to me, that this would filter out the mud and we'd all have lovely fresh carp over Christmas. Baked according to Fat Piers's special recipe, they said. We ate until we were stuffed. It was all delicious and fresh. Most of what we were eating had travelled food yards rather than food miles. These were the days when people made their own entertainment. Yes, there were jesters, strolling minstrels, troops of acrobats, conjurers and so on, but few of them ever made it past Rushford to our remote manor. So we did it ourselves. There were songs and stories. Everyone already knew the story word for word, but that was the point. Breath was held at the exciting bits. Even children sat silent and enthralled. King Arthur was a special favourite. Everyone took part, even me. Somewhat nervously, I gave them the hastily edited story of Sir Luke Skywalker, Jedi Knight of great renown, and the wicked dragon Darth Vader, complete with asthmatic breathing and hollow voice. I'll admit I did get a little carried away during the final duel, as the wicked dragon fell, pierced by the sword of the true knight, Sir Luke, to perish in his own flames. It seemed to go quite well. People nodded. Evil is always vanquished in the end. But not for me. For me, evil won every time. I sat by the hearth, staring into the flames and trying not to think of last Christmas, when Leon, Matthew and I had been together. I kept hearing Matthew's voice. Mummy's awesome. I truly felt I had begun to make some progress with him. Where did he think I was now? What had the time police told him? Had he even noticed I wasn't around? And Leon? What of Leon? I'd been gone 7 or 8 months. For him, it might be even longer. Had he moved on? Worse, had he moved out of St. Mary's altogether? He was always threatening to go and work on the Mars project, especially when the history department had been even more rigorous than usual in their treatment of one of his beloved pods. And then I'd tell myself not to be so stupid. Leon would never stop looking for me. There was every chance he'd walk through the door any moment now, heading up a rescue party. Peterson would be there too, and Markham, shambolic and scruffy, and with a better handle on what was happening than anyone else. Sometimes I would actually raise my head and look at the door, and, of course, nothing would happen, and I would sigh and carry on with whatever I was doing. Twelfth Night came and went with all the usual festivities. The decorations were taken down, and reluctantly we all went back to work.
We'd had a white Christmas. No one got excited about it. There had been a mini ice age in the 14th century, and most Christmases were white. Snow fell every night as the weather worsened. As the snow fell, the need for firewood rose. There were a lot of us out in the woods these days. William was a liberal master who saw no reason why anyone should be cold, but there was never enough wood. Temperatures dropped. The snow became crispy and sparkled in the weak winter sunshine. Trust me, snow is no fun when you have no dry shoes to change into. I dried mine in front of the fire every night, and it wasn't doing the leather any good at all. They would probably last out the winter, but a pair of shoes was the next thing on my list. I missed my old boots, lifelong companions who would almost certainly outlive me. On one cold, sparkling day, I was tramping through the snow under a deep blue sky. It was so cold, even the birds weren't singing. I was following William the Carpenter's flat wagon down a snowy track as we picked up more firewood. Every day we had to range further and further afield. I had an armful and was hastening to catch him up when, on my right, a bush waved violently, shedding snow in all directions, and someone said, "Psst!" or the medieval equivalent, anyway. My heart soared. I couldn't believe it. They'd found me. Somehow St. Mary's had found me. At last! I had no idea how, but they'd found me. Checking no one was looking, I put down my wood, stepped off the track, and someone dropped something over my head and held it tightly. I kicked out, but he was very strong. I struggled like a madwoman, but my arms were pinioned. I tried to shout, but I had a mouthful of what tasted like old sack. I was literally helpless. My feet were off the ground, and I couldn't get a purchase. I couldn't see, couldn't hear, couldn't breathe. I think I was only out for a few moments. When I was able to take notice again, the wood was completely silent. No voices called to each other. No patient tramp of William Carpenter's aged horse. No creak of wagon wheels, nothing. As far as I could ascertain, I was hanging, limp, in someone's arms. I stayed that way while I tried to work out what was happening. It seemed safe to assume this wasn't a St. Mary's rescue mission. The second thought was Ronan. That somehow he'd wormed the truth out of my two pleasant but very incompetent kidnappers and turned up in person to finish me off. That didn't seem tremendously likely either. And then he shifted me slightly in his arms. I'm not light, and I caught a forgotten but familiar scent. Onions and urine. Shit. Shit, shit, shit! Now I was in trouble. I kicked out again and began to struggle. I had to tear myself free while William Carpenter was within earshot, although whether he would hear me over the clump of his horse's hooves and the creak of his ancient cart, I had no idea, and every step took him further away from me and into the white, misty, sound-swallowing woods. My captor cursed, and changing to a one-handed grip, he punched me hard in the kidneys, which shut me up for a while as I was carted off through the woods. He didn't have it all his own way. I'm not light, and the going was rough underfoot. He stumbled several times, once falling almost to his knees. I could hear his laboured breathing and the occasional curse. In all too short a time, I heard a muttered exchange, and I was chucked into the back of what I presumed was another cart. Someone climbed in after me and passed the time trying to put his hand up my skirt. I kicked out hard, and something connected somewhere because he gave a sharp cry of pain. Someone else told him to keep quiet, chirped at his horse, and we bumped our way along a rough track. The journey seemed over with very quickly. I wasn't sure if this was good or bad. I was dragged from the cart, set on my feet with a jolt, and pushed forwards. Ahead of me, I heard a door open. I tripped up a step and knew by the sudden changes in sound and temperature that I was inside. Someone pulled off my hood and finally I could see. I shook my hair off my face and stared around, no little outraged. In fact, I was absolutely bloody furious. Seriously? Seriously? How many times could one person be kidnapped? It was like those Russian dolls. This was a kidnap inside a kidnap, for crying out loud. Bloody bollocking hell. A lot of people would suffer for this, and not one of them was going to be me. Two men stood in front of me, and as far as I could make out, another two behind me. My heart sank. The two I could see were Guy and Gerald, formerly of Rushford. This was a revenge kidnapping,
rather along the lines of Greeks snatching each other's princesses, as described by that shit-faced bastard Herodotus. Of course, again according to Herodotus, that all ended with the fall of Troy and death and destruction on a massive scale. Well, that would give me something to aim at, because I was bloody livid. I'd had enough. I was sick to bloody death of bloody men swanning into my life, picking me up and dumping me somewhere else. Well, no more. I might not be able to do anything about Ronan, but this lot were bloody well going down, and I would be the one to do it. They would live just long enough to regret the day they ever clapped eyes on me. Looking at them now, I could see that neither was as sleek and prosperous as they'd been 6 months ago, before they'd tangled with St. Mary's. Their clothes were worn and smelled none too fresh. I was guessing neither of them knew how to use a needle or mend their own gear, so they were beginning to look very shabby. Guy was paying off Onion Man and his friend, so I guessed the Rushford boys lived here alone, in what was probably some sort of hunting lodge. We were in a square stone room, quite snugly fitted out with a blazing fire, two chairs, and a table with several flagons of wine. A couple of faded tapestries hung on the wall, and had done so for some considerable time by the looks of them. I wondered if this had once been a favoured meeting place for the Rushford men and their mistresses, or boyfriends, of course. Or, looking at Gerard, a favourite sheep. This was somewhere deep in the forest, quiet and private. Just like the Rushford boys themselves, however, it had seen better days. Yeah, well, that's what happens to people who tangle with St. Mary's. Things never end well. And they were about to get a whole lot worse, and not for me. I really was feeling quite belligerent. Over in the corner, a door led to what I guessed was some sort of kitchen, because they had to have had somewhere to prepare the results of their day's hunting. And in the other corner, a rickety, a very rickety, flight of stairs that wasn't much more than a ladder led up to God knows where. At least one other room, possibly two, maybe even three, depending on how many guests they were in the habit of entertaining. I wondered if William Hendred was aware of this place, or even Hugh Armstrong. If I was looking for the Rushfords, this was the first place I would have looked. Oh, of course. Guy and Gerald had hidden, waited for the place to be searched, and then moved in. Once it was all clear. Very few people think to go back and search a place twice. Guy tossed the two men a small leather purse, jerking his head at the door. They were to get out. Onion Man sent me one last knowing leer, and the two of them filed out of the door, slamming it behind them. I didn't bother to watch them go. I moved to the fire and held out my numb hands to the flames. To be honest, I was at a bit of a loss as to why I was here. If they wanted someone to keep them warm these long, cold nights, there were younger and prettier women than me around. For Gerald, there were younger and prettier sheep around than me, and surely I wasn't important enough for a bit of petty personal revenge. I suppose it was possible they knew it had been my idea to take their castle, but this was 1400. Women didn't have ideas, and if they did, some man was usually able to persuade them that the idea had been his all along. A wise woman would nod, smile, think, cretin, and go off to feed the poultry. The fire crackled. Behind me I could hear Gerald pouring wine. Bet there wasn't one for me. I was wrong. He poured three beakers, and Guy passed one to me. I sniffed it, suspiciously. He smiled at this, but said nothing. From the brief glimpse I'd had of Guy back at St. Mary's, I'd had the impression of a dark, powerful man. Now I'd seen Hugh Armstrong as well, I could see there was a vague resemblance around the mouth and nose. Other than that, there were no similarities. Hugh was tall, fair, and built like a whippet who hadn't had a good meal for a month. Guy was a bulky bully. A part of my mind said, Norman. And then we were joined by Gerald the Gormless, who didn't look like anyone in particular, for which the rest of the human race was probably very grateful. The last time I'd seen him had been on the end of Marjorie's bucket when he'd fallen into the burning shed. She should have let me fish him out. One side of his face was red and shiny, and a large patch of his hair had burned away, revealing puckered skin. I was betting it wouldn't ever grow back. That had been a bad day for the Rushfords. Guy had lost his title and his lands, and Gerald had lost what little looks he'd had to begin with. Now he was something to frighten small children.
They stood together, looking at me. I was determined not to speak first.
Nothing undermines your position as much as hysterically demanding an explanation for this outrage.
I turned to look at the flames and pretended I didn't care.
The foreign woman,
said Guy in Latin, so he knew all about me. I said nothing.
The masterless woman,
he sipped.
No one's property.
I wondered if I could get away with pretending I didn't understand him. On the other hand, if he was busy talking, then he wasn't doing anything more unpleasant to me.
I nodded and said in English,
Yep, that's me.
He frowned at these strange words.
Gerald finished his wine and poured another. His brother told him sharply that he'd already had too much. Defiantly, Gerald tossed it back.
Guy was waiting for me to have hysterics, demand to be released, burst into tears, plead for mercy, and so on.
I sipped my wine. It wasn't bad. Better than I usually got, anyway.
I sipped some more.
I have some of my best ideas when I've had a few drinks. Or so it always seems at the time.
Do you understand me?
I nodded with my, of course I understand you, do you take me for a complete idiot, expression, and still didn't ask why I was here. I suspected he was dying to tell me anyway.
Revenge.
Well, yes, I'd gathered that.
Yes, I said, slowly, so he could understand me. That is obvious. It is my role in your revenge that is not clear.
I seek to destroy Hugh Armstrong. To get to him, I must break his good friend and ally, William Hendred. An almost impossible task, I thought, until someone told me of the foreign woman he so dotes upon. And so, to break William Hendred, I must hurt you.
My heart began to thump, but I pretended to consider this.
Yes, I see. A good plan. May I have some more wine, please?
His mouth crooked in a rather unpleasant smile.
Do you think that is wise?
I rather suspect I'm going to need it. He nodded an acknowledgement and poured it himself. Gerald, the one who was causing me the most concern, was alternately staring at me and then at the fire. Unconsciously, he reached up and touched his burned face. I had to get out of here.
Guy was speaking again.
I confess I have never had any love for Master Hendred, and now I find myself harbouring a desire to do him as much damage as possible, starting with you.
Yes, I said slowly. I think you should be the one to start with me.
He frowned. I nodded at Gerald.
If you want your share of revenge, then you should go first. I suspect once Master Gerald starts, then for me, it will all be over with very quickly. We both know he is not always in control of himself.
It was a shot in the dark, but not a wild one. I had heard enough gossip about Gerald. I drained my beaker. The wine was really rather good. I watched the corners of the room blur in a way that wasn't completely because I can't see that well these days. I wasn't sure whether the wine was a good move or not, but at this precise moment, I needed all the courage I could get. He ran his hand down my breast.
You seem strangely amenable.
I don't know why people think I'm not amenable. I really don't. I sighed.
I have been the property of William Hendred for 6 months. He has not used me well.
He stood very close.
I shall not use you well either.
I moved even closer to him and looked him in the eye. William Hendred is overrated.
Are you?
We were chest to chest.
Ah, now that is a word that has never been used to describe my performance.
I made a small sound of contempt. That is what all men say. He went to speak, but was interrupted by Gerald banging his beaker on the table.
Stop talking all the time, you promise me.
His brother broke eye contact and turned to him.
Drink more wine, Gerald. Leave us to talk.
I gave him a small half-smile.
Oh, more talk. Always more talk.
He looked down at me.
I wonder about you.
Many do.
I wonder whether you are the very clever woman I think you might be.
I drank more wine. Bloody hell, this was good stuff.
I am clever enough to see the flaw, the enormous flaw in this great plan of yours.
It broke the spell. He stepped back.
What enormous flaw?
I stepped back too, ignoring Gerald as if he didn't exist. I picked up a flagon and two beakers and set off for the stairs. Guy caught me in two long strides.
Oh, no, I do not let you out of my sight.
I sighed theatrically. 2 minutes is all I need.
For what purpose?
I sighed again. Preparations. Women's things. You can get away with murder simply by citing women's things. The phrase women's things implies all sorts of dark and dubious female mysteries that men don't have a clue about, especially in this medieval day and age, but also in the future too. Pre-Dr. Bairstow, I'd once had a boss who was a complete moron, and he demanded, at the top of his voice, in front of an entire room full of men, exactly why I'd made a simple mistake on some paperwork. I let the silence gather, and then boomed, "Pre-menstrual tension, I expect," in a voice that bounced off three continents. He left me alone after that. Guy and I locked eyes. I forced myself not to look away, and then he said,
"Let me show you the way."
Gerald set up the wail of a petulant child.
"What about me?"
Guy spoke to Gerald, but looked at me.
"Your turn will come. This is but a short interlude."
A chill ran down my back. I hadn't fooled him at all. But if I could just have a few minutes on my own, a few minutes to sum up the situation, a few minutes to have a bit of a think. There were two doors at the top of the stairs, one left and one right. He opened the left-hand door and pushed me inside. The cold room was empty apart from a bed. Not even a stool to wallop him round the head with. He walked to the window.
"Too high to jump. You would almost certainly injure yourself quite badly. And you should know, I would not let that stop me. It might even add to my enjoyment."
I swallowed hard and pushed away thoughts of broken legs and ruptured spleens and Guy of Rushford's excruciating weight and fought to keep my voice steady. "I understand."
"I do wonder about you,"
he said again, looking at me. I said nothing. He backed out of the room. I waited for the sounds of a key turning, but he had a bar across the door instead. I'd had some thought of pushing the key out of the lock, pulling it under the door and escaping that way, but there's no escaping from a barred door. I ran to the window. It was indeed too high. There was no point in jumping and breaking both my legs. I stared around the room. Nothing. Yes, there was. There was a bed, with covers. I pulled them back. Sheets, yes! Have you ever tried to tear a sheet? It can't be done. Yes, easy enough if you can start it off with a pair of scissors or a knife, but my knife was back at St. Mary's. I tugged and tugged. Panic gave me a strength I didn't know I had, but I couldn't do anything, and they were too bulky to knot together. And this wasn't a four-poster. There was nothing I could tie them to anyway. I ran to the window again. A dark courtyard. A dim building opposite. Stables, probably. Snow covered everything, and a bright moon. When had it got dark? How long had I been here? I ran back to the door and stood listening. Voices. They were talking together. And back to the window again. I stared down at the snow, and then I had a brilliant idea. I ripped off my cloak and dress, not without some reluctance, the night was bloody freezing. Seizing the big feather bolster, I stuffed it inside the dress and wrapped my cloak over everything. I went back to the window and pushed the shutter wide open. I had to do this right. I would only ever get one chance. I remembered to brush the snow off the windowsill, then I leaned out as far as I could, screamed so long and loudly that I hurt my throat, and let the bolster fall. It plumped into the snow below. I was staggered. It looked amazingly realistic. My cloak covered a pathetic little mound in the snow. You could just see my dress underneath. It looked for all the world as if a terrified woman had risked everything by jumping from an upstairs window, and it hadn't worked. I ran back and hid behind the door. As I hoped, I could hear footsteps pounding up the stairs. I was in luck. Both of them burst into the room. Guy took one look at the open shutter, at the snow-free windowsill, cursed horribly and ran to the window, closely followed by Gerald. My instinct was to run now, to get out of here as quickly as possible, but I made myself wait until they were at the window and leaning out, as far away as possible, and then I whisked myself through the door and out onto the landing. They'd left the bar. I pulled the door shut, fumbled for a horrible moment, and then slammed the bar into place just as Guy reached the door and tugged, The door shifted slightly, but the bar was solid. I was safe. He rattled the latch and banged furiously on the door.
Open this door! I order you to open this door!
Why do people do that? Was it likely I was going to open the bloody door? Silly sod.
I scampered back down the stairs, stumbling over the last few because, A, they were very steep and very rickety and swayed every time I went near them. B, yes, all right, I'd had a few and the alcohol had gone straight to my legs. C, actually the whole world was swaying around me in a manner probably not unconnected with B. Back in the downstairs room, I took a moment to give the place a quick survey, mentally sorting the contents into A, things that would burn, B, things that probably wouldn't burn unless helped on their way, C, things that definitely wouldn't burn. I kicked over the table, scattering wine everywhere. I added the wooden stools to the pile, tugged at the tapestries which fell off the wall at my first touch, enveloping me in a dusty, musty darkness. Coughing, I fought my way free and added them to the pile. They'd burn, I was sure of it. Picking up every oil light I could find, I emptied the contents over the heap and laid a trail to the fire. I think I might have misjudged things slightly because there was a kind of whoosh noise coupled with a sudden blast of heat and I might have lost my eyebrows. I opened the doors to give a nice through draught and left everything to find its own path through today's events. There was a torch burning by the front door, which was thoughtful of someone. I yanked it from its sconce and stepped out into the yard. Gerald was leaning out of the upstairs window, shrieking with fear. I felt a moment's compassion. He'd burned once. On the other hand, this is what happens when you kidnap an historian. We don't like it, you know. He shouted over his shoulder, and Guy appeared, bellowing commands for me to let him out immediately. Yes, he really hadn't thought that one through at all, had he? I ran to my pile of clothes and yanked the bolster free. The night was freezing. I had to have clothing, or I'd be dead in an hour. Guy and Gerald were both leaning dangerously far out of the window. I paused and frowned. How long before they stopped shouting and started thinking? If Guy, the stronger of the two, dangled Gerald from the window, he'd be a good 6 feet or more nearer the ground. Dropping from that reduced height might mean nothing more than a sprained ankle. He'd be straight up the stairs to free Guy, and then I'd really be in trouble. I'd be lucky if they only killed me, but there might be something I could do about that. I shot over to the stables, and yes, I was running around like a headless chicken, but I was terrified they were going to get free, and I had to use the little time I had to make sure they weren't able to come after me. They were going to free themselves at some point, and I couldn't see my little fire doing a lot of damage to a stone building. There were two horses currently in residence. One I completely ignored. A huge destrier, with a nasty look in its eye, already restless at the smell of smoke, and about the size of a 3-story block of flats, rolled an eye at me. I pulled on his tether to free him, from a safe distance, obviously, because although I had no problem with toasting Guy and Gerald, it didn't seem right to do it to their horses. The other occupant was Gerald's seriously yellow horse. It looked back at me. Even at this stage I could see our relationship was going to need a lot of work. There was a pile of straw at the far wall. I held the torch there for just long enough for a flame to catch, and then I was off. No time for a bridle. The yellow horse was halted, and that would just have to do. I dragged it out into the yard, stepping smartly aside as Big Boy thundered past me and down the track. I did panic that the yellow horse might follow him, but, as I was to discover, the yellow horse did not do thundering. I turned for one final look. Gerald was indeed being dangled from the upstairs window. Guy was bellowing at him to let go, and Gerald was whimpering and kicking and clinging on for dear life. I carefully tugged the heavy bolster into position directly beneath them. They both stopped shouting and stared at this suspicious piece of consideration. And they were right to do so, because I tossed the torch on top of it. Feathers aren't particularly flammable, but anything will burn if you hold a flame to it for long enough. Gerald's whimpering turned to a shriek as the flames grew higher. I no longer cared. I scrambled aboard the yellow horse and took one last look around. Flames were licking around the front doorway. The interior was roaring nicely. The stables were well ablaze. Even the bolster had joined in the spirit of things. Guy and Gerald were blaspheming into the uncaring night,
I gave them an historically inaccurate finger. My work here was done. Time to go. Chapter 27. I'd like to say I thundered out of the yard and into the night. I mean, on the strength of my performance so far, you'd think a good thunder would be the least the God of historians could grant me, wouldn't you? That bloody horse. That bloody, bloody horse. I thundered out of the yard and out into the night at a gentle canter. Slow, sedate, and majestic. Not what you look for in a getaway horse. I should have stuck with Guy's Destrier, but it would have dumped me in the nearest ditch and then eaten me. But at least I might have been a mile or so away before that happened. Even if I'd never seen him before, I could have told you this was Gerald's horse. He could no more ride a Destrier than fly to the moon, or stop picking his nose in public. It was just right for him, slow and sedate, a horse with only one gear. In vain did I drum my heels against his sides. He ignored me. I lashed him with the end of the halter rope. He ignored me. I shouted at him. He ignored me. Glancing back over my shoulder, the whole area was ablaze. People would come to investigate. Perhaps the trees would catch fire as well. Oh, God, this might burn down the entire wood, and what would Hugh Armstrong have to say to me then? Perhaps I could offer him the yellow horse as payment. We cantered gently down the track and through the trees. The moon was up and full, and the yellow horse seemed full of purpose and direction, so I left him to his own devices while I had a bit of a think. I didn't have the slightest idea where I was in relation to St. Mary's. I wondered if anyone was out looking for me. If anyone was out on this freezing night, they'd head straight for the burning glow amongst the trees. Should I hang around to see if someone turned up, or should I get as far away as possible in case Guy and Gerald had managed to free themselves? That's the problem with being kidnapped. Escaping is the easy bit. It's what to do afterwards that's the bummer. For all I knew, I was cantering majestically in the wrong direction. In fact, I probably was. And I was freezing. I had to get my clothes on again, and as soon as possible. This was no night to be out in just my tunic. The yellow horse was warm enough, so my bum was okay, but the rest of me was numb with cold. The heavens above were clear and scattered with bright stars. The moon hung in the cold sky, casting long blue shadows over the white snow. The thick white snow. If the yellow horse lost the track, stumbled and came down, or if I fell off, it would be a disaster. I needed to get as far away as I possibly could, find some shelter, get dressed, wait for the sun to come up, and then get myself back to St. Mary's. I had to warn William Hendred so he could warn Hugh Armstrong, but all I had was this bloody yellow horse, so I sat quietly and allowed him to find his own pace and his own path. We seemed to travel for a very long time, although I'm not sure it was. Eventually, the yellow horse began to pant, and then the track emerged from the trees. We stopped, our breath puffing around us. It was hard to tell under all that snow, but I think we joined a road. I looked left and right. No clues, just a blank and empty snowscape. Away on the horizon, to my right, an eerie glow lit the sky. I turned left, saying, "What do you think?" to the yellow horse. He seemed happy enough with left. He was certainly the closest thing to a sat-nav I was going to get. We trotted for a while. I bumped up and down, keeping my eyes peeled and my ears open for any sounds of pursuit. If Guy was free and had managed to recapture his horse, they could be on us in minutes. Struck by a sudden thought, I twisted around and looked behind me. Yep, a lovely set of hoof prints, sharp and clear in the bright moonlight. Bollocks. There was nothing I could do about it, however, so I urged the yellow horse onwards. Its shoulders heaved unnervingly, but I gathered this was its precursor to moving up a gear. I wondered who on earth would be stupid enough to own a horse like this. Other than Gerald, of course. We cantered merrily along, me rapidly sobering up in the cold and slowly turning blue, and the yellow horse apparently quite enjoying his night out, until finally I couldn't stand the cold any longer. I had to get my clothes back on as quickly as possible. Note to anyone interested, don't try and get dressed while riding a horse. I am aware it can be done, just not by me. I fell off. And now, because I'd fallen into the snow, I was wet as well as cold. The only good thing was that the yellow horse stopped and looked back at me with an expression of mild inquiry. I was beginning to hate that bloody horse. Actually, my fall turned out to be a good thing. In the sudden silence, I could hear hooves coming up behind me, coming up fast. There was a small copse off to one side of the road, and I set off at top speed, slipping and tumbling on the rough, snowy ground. The yellow horse, which I'd intended to leave on the road as a decoy, trotted happily along beside me. I told it to bugger off, and it ignored me. We reached the copse. I dragged the horse in beside me, hid behind a tree, shivering violently, and tried to see the road. Two riders appeared around the bend, both bending over the clear-as-day hoof marks they'd obviously been following. They reached the spot where I'd fallen off. One said something to the other, and they both laughed. I gritted my teeth. They'd pay for that. I was just in the mood. The one in front, sitting easily on his big chestnut horse, rested one gloved hand on his hip and called for me to come out. I seriously considered spending the rest of my life in that copse, but there was no real choice, was there? Clutching my bundle of clothing in one hand and the ridiculous yellow horse with the other, I scrambled down the bank and confronted William Hendred and Tam the Welshman. Again, bollocks. I stood clutching my pathetic bundle of clothing and shivering so hard it was a miracle I didn't shake something loose. He looked at me, trembling in my underwear, at the yellow horse, at the glow on the horizon, and said, "What have you done?" It was too much. His tone was mild. There was no blame in his voice, but it was still too much. Much too much on this crowded night. I didn't mean to, but I burst into tears. Blame the drink. I did. I heard him say something to Tam as he dismounted. I was shaking with cold, trying to disentangle my clothing, which was as wet as I was, sobbing like an idiot and blaming everything on the yellow horse, which was looking at me as if I were its new BFF. Well, anything was an improvement on Gerald, I suppose. William Hendred took my clothing off me and passed it to Tam. The next minute, I was up on his horse and he was swinging himself up behind me. The saddle was easily big enough for two of us. He pulled me in close, carefully wrapped his cloak around us both and urged his horse forwards. We covered the ground a lot more quickly than the yellow horse had managed, and yet, when I looked, there he was, cantering along behind us, apparently determined not to be separated from me at any cost. I know his horse was warm, as was he. I could feel the heat coming from both of them. I could feel their warmth on my skin, but nothing seemed to penetrate. It was as if I was made of ice, and nothing could touch me. I shivered and shook. Only now that there was warmth did I realize how cold I was. I should have stopped and dressed long before this. He held me tightly against him, and I clutched at his doublet with both hands. Words and pictures danced through my brain. The foreign woman he so dotes upon, dancing flames that froze in the moonlight. A yellow sea that rose and fell, rose and fell. The foreign woman, dotes upon. I think I whispered something. He clasped me harder, and I felt Theobald's muscles bunch. We bounded forwards, adrift in a world of blue and white shadows. Something touched my icy cheek. There was a world of warmth under this cloak, and I wanted to stay here forever, but I was slipping back into the icy flames. Nothing could touch me. Nothing could warm me. Dawn was breaking as we reached St. Mary's. I heard the bell ringing, cutting through my dreams. We swept into the courtyard. I could hear Tam shouting for the grooms. His voice was a long distance away. I was lifted down. I thought I heard Marjorie's voice somewhere, and then I was back in William Hendred's arms again, and he was striding towards the solar. Someone threw open the door. The heat hit me like an oven, and then we were up the stairs and into his chamber. I could hear his voice issuing instructions. There was a fire lit, but someone brought in a brazier as well. And then I was in a bed. I could hear a babble of voices. Someone held a beaker to my lips. There was a warm, sweet drink. The door banged. Silence fell. I felt him climb in behind me. The covers closed over me like a sea. I could feel the heat from his body seeping into mine. I remember giving brief thanks that at least someone knew how to treat hypothermia. And then I slept.
I woke once to the sound of the shutter rattling in its fastening. There was a violent storm out there. I could hear the wind shrieking around the walls and rain against